Grace are here and present and ready to go. Just a few items to take care of initially. When you step up to the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. Please feel free to pronounce your name and your client's name and let us know how you'd like us to refer to them and your client during the argument this morning. The rules of decorum are in place, and so you observe the rules of decorum. When you approach the podium, you can either approach, there's a microphone either next to you, you can either use that one, or you can use the one in the middle. The one in the middle does have a timer, so you can see how much time you have, which is important because you each will have 15 minutes. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal or appellant. There's also a button underneath the center podium to raise or lower the podium, so you can for your height, so you can have it for your comfort. And I believe that is everything. So with that, appellant, you are counsel for appellant. Are you ready? Please feel free to approach the podium, so you may have a record and party you are representing.
Thank you, Ron. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Cassandra Bautista. I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Aureliano Flores. For the purposes of this argument, Your Honor, I will be referring to Mr. Flores as Mr. Flores. May I also reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal? Thank you. Your Honors, this case is about an incident that happened on March 1st of 2019. Two victims subsequently gave a statement to police officers, one version of that statement. Later, feeling bad about what they said, they came clean to defense counsel, to the prosecutors, and to the court. The prosecution, seeking a conviction in this case, sought to skirt the rules of evidence and admit that prior recorded statement that was given to police officers as evidence instead of accepting live, in-person, sworn testimony.
How is that a violation? What rule of evidence would that be a violation of? If a prosecutor wanted to use the initial statement, you said it would skirt the rules of evidence to do so. What's the rule?
It would be a hearsay, Your Honor, an out-of-court statement offered to prove the matter of the truth
If it's a consistent statement, you'd agree that that would meet one of, well, it's not really an exception at that point, but under the hearsay rules, that is not hearsay.
Your Honor, in this case, it's an inconsistent statement.
Okay, so I think then your argument is it skirts the rules because it's inconsistent.
Your Honor, my argument is that it skirts the rules because it's hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, and that hearsay then doesn't fall under any of the exceptions required by the rules in order to be admitted. Specifically, under the district court's order in this case, the district court addresses two different rules, the first one being under an excited utterance, and the second one being under the residual hearsay exception, under Rule 807. Now, under Rule 807, if there's any single category of statements that should never be admitted under 807, it would be a recanted statement. There are no totality of the circumstances that lend to the credibility of that statement any longer because it has been recanted. In this case, both of the statements, the one originally given to police officers and then the one later submitted in an affidavit by both victims, you can't tell what's true anymore because you have two out-of-court statements. Neither are sworn. Both are recorded. Neither are subject to the penalties of perjury or to cross-examination. And so that goes against the court's supposed analysis of whether it was even a residual hearsay exception to be granted.
And my understanding based on your briefing is you're not challenging, and there are three requirements for that. My understanding from your briefing is you're not challenging the first two. You're just challenging whether the declarants had been under sufficient aura of excitement to ensure the trustworthiness of the statement.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yes.
I was wondering if you could focus on that because it seems to me that you look at a number of things and you argue in particular the lapse of time argument. Case law, generally when you have a statement that is within an hour or so, and this was just within minutes of the incident, so the lapse of time argument doesn't seem to be very persuasive.
Yes, Your Honor. The lapse of time argument really comes down to two different things. First, the amount of time that passed, and then second, why that matters. So the first thing is all of the case law that I've read has said that there's a differing times that can be acceptable for an excited utterance. For example, I read some cases that said up to 90 minutes is sufficient for the court. I've read other cases that says that, you know, half an hour is not sufficient, for example. And so really the subjective nature of the passage of time comes down to what's happening in that time. And I say it that way because if you have somebody who is experiencing excitement, that excitement is going to dissipate over time. And that is the insurance that essentially gives credit to the statement as being true. Now, in this case, that doesn't apply. And then only even in a short 12-minute span of time, it doesn't matter because there was no sufficient aura of excitement that either of the declarants were experiencing even when police got there. I believe it was cited in my brief, Your Honor. I can't recall the name, but it was the one that had to do with witnessing a fire. It was a building that was on fire. And I can give that name to the court after the argument is over, if you'd like.
Oh, I see. It's footnote 6 on, I believe, page 8, State v. Daniels, affirming admission of statements made within an hour of a fire. Is that the one?
I don't believe that's the one, Your Honor. I can come back to that. I apologize. But going back to, Your Honor, to what happens over time, so the point I was trying to make is that there is no sufficient indicia of excitement in this case, and that's why the passage of time doesn't matter here, because you're not...
Sorry for interrupting, but it sounds like you're conflating two factors. The factor that you're talking about, I think, really goes to the aura of excitement versus the passage of time. In terms of the aura of excitement, and I understand your argument in terms of the video as to whether or not they appear, and I think the district court even acknowledged it wasn't like they were had necessarily outward signs showing that they were still under the excitement of the incident, but we do have the testimony of one of the officers that said that GF was, quote, physically shaking, crying, and seemed to be scared, unquote, during the statement. So that seems to support the district court's determination here. And also, one of the criteria when we look at in terms of the lapse of time is whether or not there was any possible motive to falsify the testimony. And GF, it seems like it was actually the opposite. If anything, she would have had the motive to try to protect her husband. And yet she did not. She actually gave statements that were contrary to his interest and her interest as his wife. So that seems to, again, seems to support the district court's decision, doesn't it?
To respond to your first point first, Your Honor, regarding the officer's statements, I would say that normally that would at least be suggestive of what the declarant at the moment was feeling. However, in this case, I think it's different for two reasons. One, because the declarant, as the court can see on the videos, isn't exhibiting any signs that would have elicited those comments from the officer. She wasn't hyperventilating. She wasn't shaking. She wasn't crying, at least in what the court can see. And then also, the declarant, Mrs. Flores, she actually addressed her state of mind when she was making her affidavit out of court later. And she...
But that's after the fact. And while we have the video, the officer was right there in person. And as we know from even just, you know, in court versus Zoom, there's more to be observed when you're actually in the room with somebody versus watching somebody on a videotape where you may not be able to pick up those nuances.
I think the differentiation here, Your Honor, would be that the officer seeing someone in a specific state and making comments related to such is different than the declarant actually being under the sufficient aura of excitement, which is what's required under this analysis.
Ms. Bautista, as we look at facts necessary to determine and apply the rules of evidence, you would agree that we're reviewing factual findings that the court makes in order to make its evidentiary decision. even though the evidentiary decision is an abuse of discretion review, we review those facts for clear error, right?
Yes.
Okay, so why is it clear error given the testimony of the officer about his observations?
It's clear error for two reasons. One, because the district court in this case didn't undergo the necessary analysis to reach the conclusion to allow the video to come in. And then second, because of the officer's officer's comments towards the victim and then later testimony about what it was that the officer was experiencing, I just go back, Your Honor, to the fact that the analysis requires that the declarant be under the sufficient aura of excitement. And I understand that an officer's comment could be suggestive or at least lead to...
I mean, they're his observations of her conduct. So it seems to me if that supports the finding that the district court makes either explicitly or impliedly regarding this state of excitement, that we would be applying clear error to that. And if there's testimony that supports it, it seems pretty persuasive, unless you can explain why that testimony should be disregarded.
In this case, because this was a motion in limine, that fact actually wasn't before the court when the court was making this analysis about whether the videos were going to come in as excited utterances or not. The only things that the court
In order to know whether it's an excited utterance, the district court has to determine certain facts and then apply, because that's what the rules of evidence would require. So it sounds to me that the district court was doing that fact-finding at the motion in limine stage as required by the rules of evidence.
The only facts before the court, Your Honor, would have been what was contained in the video, what was made during oral arguments regarding motion in limine, and then also the affidavit of both of the declarants. In this case, per the court's order, the only things that they considered were oral argument and then a review of both of the body camera videos. The court never considered the affidavits that were made by declarants, first of all. And second of all, because this was motions in limine, like I said, the officer had not yet testified and provided that information to the court. So again, going back to the rules that were supposed to have been followed in order to either A, qualify under as an excited utterance, or B, qualify under as a residual hearsay exception under 807, the court didn't apply either analysis correctly. Your Honor, I don't believe the written police reports were part of the trial record. That would have been.
You mean the motion in limine hearing record?
Yes.
Not the trial? Okay.
Yes.
So I guess that's the question. What was presented? You don't think those reports were included in that at the motion stage?
That's correct.
Ms. Bautista, can I ask you, would you agree that when this concept of under a sufficient aura of excitement is sufficiently vague to me? Would you agree it's necessarily subjective, fact case by case? And to the extent case law has talked about it, what's the floor? Is there a description where a trial judge can look and say, well, she's below that or above that?
Your Honor, I do believe
that. This goes kind of to the questions you've been hearing already related to their clear error, because we have to have something upon which then to say it's clearly error as we look at the same thing the judge did.
Correct. I do believe that it is subjective, as you've indicated. However, I didn't find a clear error in case law either. What I did find was a bunch of different suggestions, for example, or factors to consider when deciding whether someone was under the sufficient aura of excitement. And I listed just a couple of those in my brief. I talked about the physical signs of excitement, such as fidgeting, pacing, crying, shaking, et cetera, something that would indicate somebody is in an excited state of mind. But going back to just a little bit about how the court actually issued its order, all it said was that the statements were given in the immediate aftermath of the event, both close in time and at the location of the event, period. And I'm taking that from page AA12, the district court's order. And the reason I come back to that is because there is absolutely no statement or factual support that says they were A, under the aura of excitement, B, that the event caused the excitement, for example, or to at least indicate that the district court had taken into consideration the declarant's state of mind. the district court basically just waved its wand and said, oh, you were in the same place that the statement or that the incident happened when you gave your statement, and only a couple minutes had passed, and so that counts. And it's the appellant's argument that that is not sufficient under this excited utterance rule, which is why it shouldn't have become in as an excited utterance.
Well, the district court had noted that the statements were made in the immediate aftermath of the event, both close in time and at the location of the event. So it wasn't like they had been removed from the location. So you're already at the place where the incident had happened. And the district court can consider all relevant factors. So it's not limited, but typically they look at the length of time that has elapsed. That's what the district court did. The nature of the event, the physical condition of the declarant, having viewed the video, and the district court noted that it had viewed the video, and any possible motive to falsify, but the court also looked at the fact that they were still at the location. So it appears that the district court did look at all relevant factors to make that determination. What factors are clearly erroneous that the district court considered that?
The court's reliance on close in time, I think, is erroneous, again, because we talked about the subjectivity of time and then also the location specific to this case. And I addressed that just a tiny bit when I was explaining about how where was the declarant supposed to go. And I'm talking about Mr. Roman at this time. He's not at his house. It's midnight in March in Minnesota. The officers were asking if they could use a different room to speak to him separately, and he was denied the request. So where was he supposed to go?
Discussions, the statements that were made were basically made in the same location where the incident occurred. And so I think the district court is basically inferring, well, it's reasonable to think that the person, or they were under the aura of excitement because this is where the incident had happened.
And I understand that that's what the district court seems to have at least inferred, but under all of the case law and under the rule of evidence, Your Honor, I believe that that inference was faulty, and therefore the court's ruling was faulty.
Would that inference be faulty?
That would be the Hallmark case, and then also the Robin. Oops. It would be Hallmark, Your Honor, that talks about the importance of considering all of the factors. And then also the page.
I just want to be clear what we're discussing, because it seemed to me that Judge Reyes's question was specific to either explicit or implicit finding that the statement was given in the same location as the incident. That to me is a fact issue, a fact question that you then have to use to determine whether the rules of evidence would permit, which is the discretionary part. And it sounded like you were saying that that statement, that this was the same location, requires some kind of inference, and that that inference was not permitted by the case that you were about to discuss. Am I right that you're saying that there's some inference that the district court made to conclude the location is the same, and that that inference is precluded by the case you're about to talk about?
Your Honor, what I was trying to explain was that I don't believe that it's appropriate for the district court to indicate or to rely on the fact that location of the statement is an indication of its veracity.
Okay, so that's a different argument than challenging the district court's fact finding or inference finding that the location was the same. Now you're saying that the court should have given very little weight to that fact when then applying the rules of evidence to determine this third part of the exception, right?
Yes.
Okay, and what standard of review do you think we apply to that, the amount of weight that the district court gives to that fact?
I think it's the discretionary standard, Your Honor.
And that seems to me a very different answer than the question Judge Reyes was asking, which was about the conclusion, the factual conclusion that this location is the same.
I may have misunderstood Judge Ray's original question.
I may have as well, so.
I'll just end with, because I see that I'm out of time, I think that the court's, the district court's reliance on the fact that the statement was given in the same location is misplaced. Although I do see that the court has the discretion to obviously determine where the statement was given and that that's a fact-finding issue, that's not what I'm disputing. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, State of Minnesota. The defense in this case has portrayed the prosecution as sort of out of control, presenting unconstitutional evidence in prejudicial ways with no notice and hiding things from the jury and the court and the defense. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is no basis to the defense argument of prosecutorial misconduct, which, once put through the plain error standard of review, fails to meet all four factors of the plain error standard as briefed in the state's case. I'm happy to address any questions on the prosecutorial misconduct if the court has any questions on that.
I'd prefer if you start with kind of what was before the district court at that motion hearing. And it is, I think it's a fair point that Ms. Bautista makes that in your brief, to support the district court's conclusions of fact that then underlie its discretionary, its act of discretion in applying the rule, you do point to trial testimony regarding the observations of the officer and not just relying on what was presented at the time of the hearing. So if we could put us back into that spot in time.
Sure.
What was before the district court? There's
so if
police
you turn-
reports.
If you turn to page, well, you don't need to turn to page. I will read it to you. On the trial transcript on page 38, the court says, all right, let's go back on the record. The court's going to accept the flash drive that includes the body cams of Officer Lampman, Officer Filan, and Officer Erickson. And the state is going to send digital copies of the transcriptions of the statements of Ms. Flores and Mr. Roman via email. And then they talk about the 911 call. It's not clear if the 911 call was submitted as well, but you have those three body camera videos and the transcripts of those statements. That's what was submitted at the motion in limine. So that's what the district court had.
What about the police reports that are, I think it's court exhibit, is it 001? COH-001.
It's not clear that that was submitted at the at this pretrial hearing. It wasn't at least discussed at on the transcript to page 38 when they were discussing what was part of the record for this.
I mean, the transcript portion that you read, and I don't mean to sidetrack us here, but it seemed like that transcript wasn't about what's presented to the district court in order to determine the admissibility of the statement. It seems like those are things that the district court was going to admit at trial and then require disclosure, like the body cameras. So my question is what is presented to the court in support of the motion in limine?
Well, those three body camera videos, for sure. The transcripts of those statements, for sure. And then potentially the police reports, but I could not find where that was actually done.
What about the affidavit of Ms. Flores? In your footnote 5, page 8, you say Gemma Flores agrees she was, quote, shaking and crying, quote, end quote, and then you have an explanation from the affidavit. Is that affidavit before the district court at the time of the motion hearing?
It would have been submitted by the defense months and months ahead of time, so it would be part of the record, but it was not brought up by the defense at the pretrial motion hearing in terms of arguing these issues. The defense was certainly arguing that she's a recanting victim, he's a recanting victim, but they were not specifically argued by the defense in this context. They were part of the record, however. Even if the police reports were not admitted, even if you simply go on the body camera videos, you still have sufficient evidence of all of the aura of excitement that's required. You still have the victim, Gemma Flores, and the police officer telling her, take your time, take a breath, I see you're emotional, those kinds of things. Those were all contained on those body camera videos. So that evidence was still before the court. So there is evidence of the aura of excitement, which is required under the case law. Now, it's true that Roman was more stoic, but he also testified at trial, which is after the fact, that he was nervous at the time. He'd never been in trouble. He'd never been with the police. But all of the typical signs of excitement that you would see are present in those body camera videos with Gemma Flores.
Mr. Zeller, can I ask you about that? And I did ask Ms. Bautista as well. As I looked at it, I guess what I was expecting before I looked at it was more aura of excitement. And you're just saying, as a matter of fact, you can look at it and it is. While it was soon after, I was surprised how calmly she was able to explain what happened. And so I'm just wondering, and I realize that's the subjectivity part, how are you able to just say so confidently and look at it and see that it is? What part of that, is there something in particular you would point us to? I didn't hear the, like she says, the breathing. She was, you know, kind of swaying, but of course, as you point out, other individual indicated you're dealing with law enforcement and an incident happened, and that, of course, will be the case. But I assume it has to be some ratcheted level because that's what brings it into the trustworthiness and the presumption that everything that's said is true.
Right. And so everybody responds differently, and everybody shows their stress differently. And in her case, when you watch the, but you hear her voice cracking, you see that she's rocking back and forth, you see that she's making those nervous movements, you see she's overtly crying, you see the police officer breathe, take your time, talking to her. So she does show those overt signs of aura of excitement, even though Roman shows less. Roman was much more stoic in terms of the aura of excitement.
And is that where the questions you're asked become pretty critical of what's before the court, because I can see where the observations of an officer via a police report for us might supplement what one is looking at, therefore, in order to make findings. But if that's not part of it, then we're just looking at the same thing.
Yes, that would be true in theory, but in this case, it actually is, she's saying, it's the same officer whose report you would have saying she was upset, she looked upset. That same officer is on body cam saying, breathe, take a breath, take your time. So that was before the court. That does not need to be contained in a police report, even though it was in the police report.
Again, when you say it was before the court, you're talking about the body camera and not the testimony.
Correct.
But you're saying the same officer who made those statements in the police report was the same, well, all three officers, body cams were in it, but the officer that made the statements of take your time, take a breath, is the same officer who made that report. It was officer,
yes, correct. Yes. So those are the issues with the aura of excitement. Does the court have any questions regarding the residual hearsay exception or any of the other exceptions that were addressed by the district court?
Just to clarify that there was no argument either then or now, that this also satisfies the prior consistent statement exception.
That was not presented. So the only two were excited utterance and residual hearsay exception.
Would it be your position if we were to agree with you on the excited utterance that we wouldn't even need to get into the residual hearsay?
Correct. Yes, if it's admissible under the excited utterance, that's the end of the analysis. Unless the court has any other questions on any of the other issues, I would simply ask this court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you very much. Counsel, for how
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on one comment that Mr. Zettler made about the stoicism of Mr. Roman. Of course, Mr. Roman's statements are also were before the district court and are at issue here. He, at the very least, was not exhibiting those outward signs of excitement that I was indicating earlier. And then turning to the comment that Your Honor just made about having some concerns about the residual hearsay exception, if I may, I'd like to address some of those now to answer some of those questions before the court.
Actually, I think you did a nice job in your initial, you addressed and you started off with the residual hearsay. And so I think I understand, at least for speaking for myself, I think I understand your position, your arguments, and in the briefing as well.
Okay.
I would actually like to go back to the we're not beating a dead horse here, but the length of time and the factors under the aura of excitement. And you referenced the Hallmark, I think it was the Hallmark case, correct?
Your Honor, I did reference that case, although I believe I misspoke because I think that case actually discusses Rule 807 and not
correct.
The excited utterance case. The case that I was thinking about was Page, P-A-G-E, Your Honor.
Okay. Because I did take a quick look at the Hallmark case, and one of the things that I actually, in addition to also, comments about how recorded statements actually increase the trustworthiness. And so I think that could be another factor to consider as well, that when you've got a recorded statement, particularly when it is close in time, that can actually, the case says that it can actually remove any dispute about what the declarant said. So in some ways, there's an inherent reliability with a recorded statement that happens.
To that, Your Honor, I would say, though, that if reading that line very carefully, we are to say that the recorded statement inherently gives it a level of reliability in what was said. That's very different than the reliability of the truthfulness of the statement. So the recorded issue goes to when there's an issue of, I said this, no, I didn't, yes, I did, no, I didn't, that's not at issue here. We're not saying that she made a statement in her statement to police that she's claiming she didn't make. That statement is essentially decided. It's recorded. We have a version of it that everybody can see and agree what was said. Now, the recorded issue, though, doesn't mean that it's any more truthful than, for example, an unrecorded statement. And I would also say that the affidavits that both of the declarants later submitted are in fact recorded as well. That doesn't make them any less trustworthy than the statement given to police just because it was recorded visually versus recorded on paper. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a fair distinction, but that's only one factor to take into account, and it is a recorded statement that was made shortly after the incident, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Bautista, I will take you back to the 807. I just want to quickly ask you if I understood what you said earlier as well, and I thought I saw it in your brief. Your point is the principle that it can never, a witness's own previous out-of-court statement can never be the most probative piece of that evidence if they're available to testify.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Specifically, under the analysis required in 807, where the district court conveniently left out a couple of the very important factors that needed to be considered. For example, the district court in its rule says that this, referring to the videos, is the best evidence reasonably available. And that's it. The factor actually requires that it be, the statement is more probative on point for which it is offered than any other evidence which the proponent can procure through reasonable efforts. And I asserted in my brief that the state had already had Mr. Roman and Mrs. Flores under subpoena and prepared to testify at court. I don't understand why that would be unreasonable to procure their statement when he was about to direct examine them in front of the court itself.
Ms. Bautista, what is the case or the authority that says that per se rule? If the witness is available, there is no residual exception.
I don't know that I cited to one of those in my brief, Your Honor. I don't know that I found a statement that comes down with that black and white of a rule, is what I'm trying to say. I just have very little time remaining, and so at this point, I would just reiterate for the court that the appellant is essentially seeking a fair trial, which it was, the appellant was denied his fair trial at the district court because of these unfair and prejudicial erroneous rulings of the evidence, even before trial began. And so at this time, I would ask the court to find that the district court erred and abused its discretion when coming to the conclusions about the evidence that it did. I would also ask this court, because we do have a full record before the court now, to do the analysis that the district court didn't do and reach the conclusion that neither of the hearsay exceptions apply in this case, and then remand and have the conviction vacated against Mr. Flores and set for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and